If you're looking for a detailed military account of the war in Iraq from Anne Garrow's new book, you'll be disappointed. As every public radio listener knows, Anne was NPR's correspondent in Baghdad during what she describes as the twilight between war and peace in Baghdad, and then during the weeks of bombing, the ground war in the desert, and the fall of Saddam Hussein. Like the extraordinary coverage she shared with all of us through her radio reports, her new book, Naked in Baghdad, is less about the U.S. military assault and more about the people in the capital who anticipated it, lived through it, and are now enduring its aftermath. As a war correspondent, Anne Garrows paints vivid pictures of people and events.
The wind whipped through Baghdad overnight, rustling the ubiquitous date trees and coating everything with a dusting of fine sand. The gusts are the harbinger of the short, balmy spring. Then there will be the long, scorching summer with no respite from the 130-degree oven. If war is to come, Baghdadis believe it will have to come soon. There are few options for most people. There are only a handful of shelters for Baghdad's 6 million people. And there's another widespread rumor that residents will soon no longer be permitted to leave the city. Ba'athist Party officials have gone around some neighborhoods warning people if they abandon their homes, their houses will be confiscated or destroyed.
That from a piece Anne filed from Baghdad just days before the first bomb struck. Anne Garrows is our guest today to talk about her book, Naked in Baghdad, to talk about her experiences as one of the few American journalists to stay on in the city during the war, and to take your questions. You can reach us at 800-989-8255 if you have a question about her work or if you want to talk about a particular moment from her coverage or about what she's seen in the days since the war ended in Baghdad. Again, the number is 800-989-TALK, or you can send us an email at totn@npr.org. And Annie, welcome back to Talk of the Nation. Nice to see you in person.
Nice to see you in person.
Let's get that obvious question over with first. Why naked in Baghdad and not naked in Washington?
I'm not naked, Neil.
But we don't want to give it away to the listeners.
It was a desperate attempt, is all I can say. I had a satellite phone, which was essentially illegal. The authorities want us to keep it at the information ministry, which was a key target, so I smuggled it to the hotel. And I figured if I was in the dark, so they couldn't see the antenna either from the window or see a light under the doorway, that would perhaps stop them from looking for me or thinking I was asleep. And if they indeed did knock at the door, if I turned up naked, playing on, you know, the fact I was a woman in many ways, and I would beg for a few minutes to put some clothes on before they came in, I might be able to hide the satellite phone. And Robert Siegel just came in the studio a few minutes ago, and Robert was blissfully ignorant that I was naked while I was broadcasting.
In fact, at one point in the book, it's described that one of these security sweeps did come into the room, and you didn't notice.
I thought the guy came into the room, and he had a video camera on his shoulder, and he barged in. And I thought that he was just one of the TV crews hoping to use my balcony because I had an exquisite view of the bombing from my window. And I thought it was a TV crew who would just come in, and I, you know, pushed this guy out saying, God damn it, you guys, you know, you think you can go anywhere. Get out of here. And I pushed him out of my room. And suddenly I realized that this actually was not a cameraman. This was one of the thugs, and I had gotten rid of him.
It worked.
It worked in a different way.
As we mentioned, you know, discussions of tactics and strategy, there's not a lot of that in this book. What is your philosophy of covering a war? What were you doing there?
Well, you know, I had but one small window on the war. All of us, whether it was an embedded reporter, I mean, who had their own very, you know, quite extraordinary windows on certain parts of it, people who were at the Pentagon, people who were at Central Command in Doha, I was in Baghdad. And I had been there from October in the run-up to the war. And my, you know, my philosophy was really I was a witness to what Iraqis were saying, were seeing, what they believed. And there were many different points of view, obviously. I knew full well what CNN had gone through in 91. I had watched their coverage, and I had watched the criticism of how they had been used by the Iraqis. And so, you know, I tried to be as careful as I could about what I saw and what I, and, you know, saying exactly who said what, why they believed what they thought they believed, what happened, why we believed what had happened. I mean, when the Iraqis took us to see bombing sites, you know, being very careful about not necessarily ascribing responsibility, but describing at least the scene and what Iraqis thought, since perception is a huge part of the issue.
So a witness is what you were.
That's right. I was merely a witness.
The decision to stay in Baghdad was a difficult one for not only for you, obviously you're the person most directly involved, but for National Public Radio, your editors and people higher up in the food chain than either you or me. What was the basis on which you made that decision? What were you thinking as you evaluated the risks?
Well, you know, listen, I have no death wish. Let's make that clear straight away. It was very hard for me to explain to my bosses at NPR, and I have to make it clear that they never asked me to stay. I asked to stay. And it was extremely difficult for them because I could not answer the unknowables, and there were a lot of unknowables. My gut told me I would be okay. I've done this for 25 years. I've seen lots of conflicts, and I had an extraordinary Iraqi who was working with me, and I thought I had a good chance of getting through this. Now, of course, it's very easy to say, you know, after the fact, the worst didn't happen. I wasn't killed in any bombing, and the worst fear, of course, I was not taken hostage. But I thought I had a good chance, is all I can tell you. And it was much harder for my bosses at NPR than for me. You know, Bruce Drake, the managing editor, you know, was just tortured. I mean, he cares a great deal about me, and as I found out. And, you know, for him, I mean, ultimately the buck was going to stop with him, as he said. And ultimately, you know, if I died, he'd have to write the eulogy. And I'm not making light of that. I knew that it was very hard, but I thought that I was the right person to be there at that point. I'd been there for a long time, and I thought that I would survive.
You were new to Baghdad when you arrived, and I guess it wasn't all that, long ago in the scheme of things. It was October before the war that you the war obviously began in the spring, and you were there in the fall when you first arrived in Baghdad. You hadn't been there before, even though you'd spent some time covering the first Gulf War, and obviously been to a lot of other places, Chechnya and so many other places like that. What did you think of Baghdad when you got there, and what did you think of the the way the place felt, and how people were responding to the situation?
Well, I've covered a lot of police states before, and frankly, this was not that unlike covering, say, the former Soviet Union. I arrived where people were very frightened to say what they really felt. But having been in that situation before, I sort of had a sense how to dodge my minders. The Iraqis provided us with minders. We had, you know, if you will, you know, I mean, they were sort of attached to us constantly. And the key thing was to find someone I could trust. And I did. That man was my driver, and he stayed with me on and off, and but more importantly, on throughout the entire war. And he was a great asset and window to Iraqis who sometimes I couldn't reach personally, especially during the war when the blanket of security was profound. Sometimes I had to send him out with a tape recorder. I gave him the questions. I knew who I wanted to see or couldn't see under the circumstances because I would have put their lives in jeopardy. But he would go and do things I simply couldn't do personally. So it was not the first time I'd been in a situation like that. Unlike, though, the Soviet Union, which I'd covered, where I spoke Russian and could go stand and mill in the crowds and just listen to what people were saying and hear and understand it, of course, I could not do that. So I was doubly reliant on the man I call Amr in the book. He asked me to use a pseudonym in the book. Although I have to say, I was just in Baghdad, I gave him the book to read, and finally he said, "Annie, is it too late to have my real name used?" Although he's still scared to death, but be that as it may.
We'll speak more with Anne Garrels when we come back from a short break. She's the author of a new diary about her experiences covering the war in Iraq. It's called Naked in Baghdad. If you have questions, our phone number is 800-989-8255. Our email address, totn@npr.org. Back in a moment. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Our guest today is NPR's Anne Garrels. We're talking with her about her coverage of the war as one of the few American correspondents who stayed on in Baghdad. If you heard our special coverage in the first days, this might sound familiar.
I just heard more sirens, which is always a precursor to more bombing. But there do appear to have been several locations in the city that were hit. We're not sure what, except for sure the planning ministry. And it appears that a lot of the attacks were in the west of the city, where there are two presidential compounds and intelligence buildings.
And Garrels reporting from Baghdad. If you have questions, you might give us a phone call, 800-989-8255, or send us an email, totn@npr.org. And why don't we take a caller? And joining us now is, we're trying to get to Karen, and Karen's on the line from San Diego.
Anne.
Hi, Karen.
Hi. This is so wonderful for me to be able to speak with you. I only get my news from NPR. I don't watch television. And I think I probably heard every word that you reported from Iraq. And I was just, I told my husband, I said, you have to listen to this. This is the most wonderful woman. She's taking the most unbelievable risks. And, As a former journalist and as a woman, I believe we're probably about the same age, I just wanted to let you know how much I admire you and your husband.
Yeah. No, he did. It was harder on him a lot, I think, than on me. I was so busy, I really didn't have time to honestly be scared. I mean, everybody always asks that question.
Well, you know what? I've got one of those kind, too, and one of those that just sticks in there.
Mm-hmm.
Say, you go for it, honey. And it's a wonderful thing to have. And I can hardly wait to read your book.
Thank you so much. I have to tell, and for NPR listeners in particular, when I was in a cocoon, essentially, for most of the war, and my only access was the satellite phone, which at $8 a minute is kind of expensive, so I didn't go on email a whole lot. And when I came home, there were remarkable messages from NPR listeners, and I can't thank you all enough. They went beyond professionalism to personal, to worrying, and I was enormously touched. It's very easy to look back on now. I survived the worst. I mean, I wasn't bombed and, I wasn't taken hostage. And in fact, please worry about all of my colleagues who are there now. I mean, I just got back after 6 weeks and it's pretty difficult.
Karen, I can tell you she also blushes beautifully.
Well, thank you.
Thank you, my love. It makes it all worthwhile.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye, Karen. As you mentioned, your husband, Vint Lawrence, a political cartoonist, he sent bulletins, email to many of your friends while you were in Baghdad on the various trips in and out, and they became known as Brenda bulletins.
Yes.
Because you were sort of informally named after the old comic strip star Brenda Star Reporter.
And, that's right. I became Brenda of the Berkshires.
Anyway, here's a clip of Vint reading from one of the Brenda bulletins, just to give you a flavor, and this is from February 7th.
In this lull before leaving, she cannot extend her visa and wants to play by the book so that she can get back later. Now is perhaps a good time to talk of Brenda's food groups when she's working. Basically, there are three: caffeine, nicotine, and adrenaline. When on occasion she consumes something more substantial, she dispatches it with such speed that no one has actually observed her eat.
So how come Vint gets all the good lines?
You know, I found out, and actually many have noticed, that I think my husband's a far better writer than I am. And as a friend said, you know, I reported dutifully on Baghdad, and Vint reported on me and had a field day doing it. And I think it sort of provided some sanity while he sat at home and chewed his nails.
In a way, though, being Brenda, you know, as silly as that is, but you were a different character in a way. Did that sort of separation make it easier?
Oh, for him, absolutely. I mean, it allowed him to, A, tell friends and family, you know, what was going on, and to be funny and ribald at times, and tell stories on me in a way that he could not have done, I think, if he'd used my own name, because he was scared to death. But he knew I had to do it, and he trusted me and my instincts. And we married as adults. I mean, he, you know, it was part of the deal.
Here's an email we got from Lynn Martin in Corvallis, Oregon. Dear Anne, when I heard the hotel had been bombed, I held my breath and wept when you were reported safe. Thanks for your courage and deep humanity. And I assume those were a lot of the same kinds of messages that you got.
Yes, exactly.
Back. It must have been, as you mentioned, though, much harder on Vint than it was on you in a way. I mean, you knew where you were. You knew whether you were at risk or in danger. It's always much more difficult if you're wondering.
Absolutely. I mean, you've gone through it.
Well, Leanne went through it.
Yes, Leanne went through it when Neil was taken captive in Iraq during the first Gulf War. And no, I mean, I really was so busy. And so much of covering something like this was logistics. I mean, dumb logistics. You know, first of all, getting the garbage cans to fill with water so I would have water when it went out, making sure that I had a car battery that was charged so that when the electricity went out, I had a source of power, hiding the satellite phone, which meant putting up the satellite phone and knocking it down every time I had to go on the air for NPR.
And tripping over the wire.
Oh, and tripping over the wires and then breaking the phone and then having to fix it with duct tape and, you know, all of this sort of silly stuff. And then not being able to get through on the satellite phone because the channels were overloaded during the war, and I would just finally fall asleep, you know, in sort of dialing fatigue at the end of a long night at 2 a.m., my time after I got off the air with All Things Considered. And I would then sleep like a baby, frankly. I mean, as my husband is the first to point out, sleep is something I do extremely well. And I would have to wake up in the morning, in fact, and ask my colleagues, hey, by the way, was there any bombing overnight? You
know. I have to mention, I've known you for 16 years. I have to wait for page 4 to find out you wear a hearing aid?
Yeah. I was a preemie baby, and it turns out that my hearing is impaired. I apparently had been able to deal with this hearing problem for a long time, but eventually it just went below the level where I could deal with it. I have to say, though, this desert sand in Baghdad didn't do those hearing aids any good, and they went out. So wearing a headset is actually very good.
It works pretty well. Let's get back to the callers. Gary joins us on the line from Memphis, Tennessee.
Hey, Neil, great show.
Thank you.
Ms. Garrels, it's a very interesting story you have to tell there, but I was wondering along the military lines, during the war, according to Donald Rumsfeld, precision bombing was, you know, boasted to limit civilian casualties. Since you were there in Baghdad, do you feel that it in fact did achieve that goal?
Yes. The bombing was extraordinarily precise. And frankly, it had been quite true in 91 and again in 98 when Iraqis went through another spate of bombing. And I was well aware of that. And that was one reason I was not so concerned about the bombing. And that proved to be quite true. However, when the bombing ended and the Saddam regime disappeared and literally evaporated and the troops came in on the ground, it became much more dangerous. And I think
let me interrupt to ask, though. There were two specific incidents, bombings or explosions in markets during the war that certainly the Iraqis described as examples of American attempts to go out and kill civilians. You went and covered both of those incidents, and what did you see?
Well, in one incident, I can't really tell you who was responsible. In the second incident, I I have good reason to believe, from shell casings that we found and also just the general profile of the incident, that it probably was an Iraqi rocket. And Iraqis there told me that that's what they believed it to be. And there were many incidents, in fact, when the Iraqis took us out to show us civilian casualties, bombing of housing. And the stories never quite added up. And in one case, I picked up, the remnants of shell casings. And Amr looked at it, and he, as you will find out in the book, in fact, had been a military officer once upon a time, looked at this and said, that's an Iraqi aircraft, an Iraqi rocket.
Mm-hmm.
So, but that did not add to our safety or the safety of the Iraqis. I mean, a war was underway, and whether they were being hit by, you know, Iraqi rockets or American bombs, you know, it was dangerous.
Miss Garrels, may I ask, do you have any insights as to, now that we've won the war, how we could possibly win the peace over there?
Well, I think the administration is now beginning to realize, somewhat late in the day, how complicated it will be on the ground. I saw in the immediate aftermath how ill-prepared the Americans were. We saw the, you know, immediately in the vacuum of the as Saddam and his security and military evaporated literally, and the looting and the arson began, and tragically, and Pentagon officials now, you know, admit to me personally that this was indeed tragic. American troops did not stop the looting, were ill-prepared for it, although they did protect one building in Baghdad, the oil ministry. And unfortunately, that was, in the Iraqi view, the only building they protected, and so only reinforced the suspicions and concerns and sort of ignorance of Iraqis of exactly why the Americans had come into Baghdad, that just confirmed in their view that they had come for oil and oil only. The problem now is that having, with the looting and the arson that was done by both, you know, poor Iraqis out of the slums who had come to sort of revenge, you know, but also Saddam's people who had, I think, come in and deliberately made it more difficult for the Americans in the aftermath. You have, you know, no ministry and government buildings that are functioning. They are gutted. Records are gone. I mean, just think about it for a moment. License plates, you know, being able to trace license plates in a security vacuum where you're trying to find out who's who, what's what, who's creating, who's doing these bombings, who's running around. You have no records.
Do you think time will heal the chaos over there?
You know, I have said from the very, I do not make predictions. That is not my job. However, I am seeing on the ground that, you know, they are increasingly trying to address the security vacuum. However, we have lost 4 months in the process. The U.S. is training police, reevaluating its dismissal of the military, you know, the blank dismissal of the disbanding of the Iraqi military, which put 400,000 unemployed disgruntled people out on the streets, now realizing that it may need some of those officers that you know, I can only say again and again that the issue now in Iraq is security, security, security for Iraqis and for the Americans.
We're speaking with Anne Garrels. Her newly published book is called Naked in Baghdad. It's an account of her experiences covering the recent war in Iraq. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. We were discussing casualties in Baghdad a moment ago, and obviously it got a lot more dangerous when the ground war got to the city. An email question from Roy Adams in Salt Lake City and Dahran, Saudi Arabia, he says, would you please elaborate on the incredibly brave episode in which you and your driver drove into an active firefight and rescued a civilian Iraqi who was wounded and unable to get out of the line of fire? Did he live? Was your car hit? Did the two of you even think of the danger you would incur by rescuing the civilian, or did you just look at each other and go?
Thank you very much for the question. I did not intend to drive into a firefight. It was in the immediate aftermath after the troops came in, and there was a lot of, you know, pockets of firefighting. We saw the arrival, as we had, in fact, for weeks, of foreign fighters And once again, the Iraqis had predicted that foreign fighters would be coming in, that there was a lot of opportunism from neighbors that would happen, neighboring countries. And lo and behold, we thought we were in a safe part of town, and we were in the middle of a firefight. The Iraqis in the area, you know, begged us to go down and save a man who was in fact in a car that was on fire. There was nothing we could have done, and he was in the middle of tank and small arms fire. There was no way we could go down there. But you're right. In this other case, there was a man a block and a half down, and we both, Amr and I, just looked at each other and went, "We can get him. We can save him. It's okay." And I'm an EMT at home, and so, you know, I was sort of wearing any number of hats all at the same time. But we could get him, and without undue danger to ourselves. And we got him and brought him home, and he's okay. I can tell you that he's just fine.
Let's go now to Henry, and Henry's with us from Xenia, Ohio.
Hi. A two-part question. On the tank that fired at the Palestine Hotel, I've never heard any follow-up reporting on it, so just curious about that. And then also, is without giving any blame, is there any chance that the sunlight reflecting off the lenses of the photographers might have appeared as flashes for the GIs on the ground?
This, of course, the incident where the tank opened fire on the Palestine Hotel and killed two reporters.
Right.
Yes, I was in my room about to go on the air for Morning Edition when suddenly there was this huge blast. And because the bombing had been so accurate, I was literally blown off my chair. But I assumed it was another bomb that it landed close. And I got a phone call from Amr about 2 seconds later. And I thought he was going to tell me that Baghdad Bob, you know, the infamous information minister, was about to give another elucidating press conference. And I was sort of saying, "Hey, I'm about to go in the air." And he's going, "No, hotel hit, out now." And so I raced out of the hotel. The explanations that the Pentagon has since said that after many different versions of events, that they believe that there were spotters in the hotel for directing attacks on the American troops. It is not if you look on the Committee to Protect Journalists, they've actually documented conversations between the tank commander at the time and the troops on the ground and what exactly happened. And it's not so clear that let me just say that the Palestine Hotel was a very distinct architectural, you know, it was very clear what it was. And it was very clear that all the journalists in town were there. We were all on our balconies. There was no outgoing fire from that building. We were on the roofs, on the balconies, watching the firefight in front of us. There was absolutely no question of any outgoing fire. None of us, if we had seen it, we would have been the first to say so. It is possible that, I mean, in the troops, it is since then the Pentagon has said that they thought that there were, you know, people using binoculars. Well, there were. There were about, you know, 120 journalists using binoculars in that building. The explanations are not very good from the Pentagon, but it was, I think, a terrible mistake that sadly happened.
Committee to Protect Journalists, as Ann Garrels has mentioned, has done an extensive follow-up report on that. We're going to be back with more of your questions and emails for Ann Garrels after a short break. 800-989-8255, TOTN at NPR.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Among the stories that NPR News is covering today is word from California that the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals has postponed the California recall election scheduled for October 7th, but that is pending an appeal to the Supreme Court of the United States. More on that later today on All Things Considered. Tomorrow on Talk of the Nation, we'll discuss the collapse of the World Trade Organization negotiations and the role of agricultural subsidies in trade and international relations. That's tomorrow on Talk of the Nation. Today we're speaking with Ann Garrels, who was our eyes and ears in Baghdad during the war. Here is her description of the city when the Americans were moving into Baghdad and as it became clear that the Saddam Hussein regime was finished.
Something just snapped. And then when the first looters went out and nothing happened, And then more looters went out, and then the troops came right into the center of the city. It just one thing piled onto the other. And it was only late today, really just at dusk, that women and children came out. You know, they didn't get the confidence to come out until much later.
Ann Garrell's reporting from Baghdad. Today she's with us here in Studio 3A. You can join us, 800-989-8255, or send us email at totn@npr.org. You've been talking about Amer, your driver and your confidant, really. Tell us more about him. You met through, you wouldn't expect to meet somebody you would trust so much quite through the Ministry of Information in Baghdad, would you?
Well, he wasn't a minder, and he was very clear about that. He was a driver. And in fact, I mean, the first day we met in October, there was sort of a feeling out between the two of us. The minder happened to be in another car, and Amer and I were out driving, and it was just after Saddam Hussein had let all the prisoners out. And it was my first day in Baghdad. We're driving along. There were hundreds of people standing by the side of the road, and I had no idea where I was. I had no idea who they were. And he just looked at me and he said, "Families of political prisoners."
Hmm.
Well, that was quite something for somebody to admit. And then he sort of laid out the rules and said when the minder was in the car, he'd be nothing but a dumb driver and wouldn't talk. He could not be asked to translate, even though he did speak some English. And later that day, I went back to the hotel, dismissed him, told him to go off. I had some things to do. And I went and took a taxi and went back to those families of political prisoners without him. I could not put him in jeopardy. It was obviously far too dangerous. And for him, I mean, the worst that could happen to me was I'd be expelled from the country. So I went and I talked to them to confirm that indeed that's who they were. But I had no translator. I'm waiting through with a tape recorder going, just running, and, sort of saying, who are you? What's going on? Did anybody speak English? When I got back just now, and I was back for 6 weeks to cover the aftermath, I gave him the book to read, and he read that episode and said, "You didn't, wait a minute, I know you. I dropped you off at the hotel." And I said, "Yeah, well, I went back." And then he said, "You did me," as he said. And I said, "Well, I did you, actually, on a couple of occasions. I didn't want to hurt you." And but as time evolved, and especially in the weeks up to and then during the war, he was extraordinary.
Let's get a call in. Liza joins us on the line from Baltimore.
Hello, yes, thank you for taking the call.
Sure.
I listened to another interview as well as all of this one, the previous one on Fresh Air, and you did speak about your driver and, of course, how helpful he was to you, but also that you felt while in Iraq you could not reveal certain things because they were pieces of information that he had provided to you and that you were concerned for his safety. And given the fact that you were one of a handful of reporters that remained, I assume you were pretty closely watched. And even with the use of a pseudonym, I wonder what gives you comfort that revealing these stories now does not place the driver at risk.
Well, I assure you I did not write this before talking to him and asking him if it was okay. And I can only say that when he read the book, he said, "Is it okay if you use my real name now?" But of course, the book was already in print.
I mentioned that earlier. Yeah.
Right. And having said that, he is afraid to this day. He's afraid of Iraqis. He's afraid of the American troops, who are a very blunt police instrument. Amer actually comes from a region of Iraq where the opposition to the Americans is strongest, although he is by no means anti-American. He, just like many Iraqis, feels lost. He sent me an email at one point immediately after I left and the Americans were in Baghdad just saying, "I feel lost. I no longer know who Iraqis are, who I am." And I think to this day that's how many people feel. But it's a very good question you asked, and one I consulted with him about before I wrote the book.
As you were leaving, just at the end, Amer made sort of a confession to you, didn't he?
Neil, do you want me to, spill
Give
the best
the
part
ending?
Of the book?
Yes.
It's a Yeah, I mean, at the last night we were together, he looked at me and he said, "I'd always told you I was a school teacher, but I wasn't." And then he told me something else. And then I'm not going to tell you the entire story. You have to read the book. But then he also looked at me and he said, "Okay, I've told you who I am. Now tell me who you are. Are you a CIA agent?" And of course, as in all police states, they use their journalists as spies, and they assume that we all were spies. And he had defended me, as it turned out. I mean, I had thought I was below the radar, being with NPR, not nearly as high profile, say, as the Washington Post or the New York Times or the networks, who weren't there during the war, but who the Iraqis had focused on, in many ways. But as it turned out, I had not been as much below the radar as I had anticipated, and Amr had been approached on many occasions to sort of look out for me because I was probably a spy, and he would just say, "Ah, oh, she's just some dumb broad,
Yet,
and deflected a lot of attention and saved me in many ways that I did not know until much later.
the press corps, though, may not have been pristine. You suggest at one point that a British reporter of your acquaintance is leaving, not because of the risk or because he was afraid, but because his company was sending in people who he thought would compromise his security because you suggest they were spies.
That's right. A very good friend of mine who was in Baghdad, and I was relieved to see he was going to be staying, at the last minute said he was leaving, and I said, "What the hell's going on?" Because I knew that on his own he wouldn't be pulling out. And he said, "Well, I've just found out that my company's sending in people who are not journalists." I mean, the implication clearly being that they're military.
A tight group of people you describe of the people who stayed on in Baghdad. The reporters obviously had to learn to trust and to know each other. Yet, exceptions, a Canadian reporter who reveled in getting a rival expelled or prevented from coming in, and a Greek woman reporter who cooperated with Iraqi intelligence because she thought it would make her a star.
Yes, I mean the press corps these days is a big unwieldy mass. Before the war, and before everybody sort of got pared down, there were 500 people from all over the world, with very different agendas. It's not like the old days when there were maybe 100 people at a given situation like this. It's a much larger group, and you don't know who's who. And we saw in Afghanistan, people posing as journalists killed Massoud, one of the Afghan leaders. I mean, that actually had happened even in Nicaragua when I was working there. And in fact, I was on the scene when, I mean, this happened in 1984. People posing as journalists got access. So it's not the way it used to be. But I have to say,
If it
though,
ever was.
if it ever was, right. But you did know people better. Now, you just don't know who all these people are. They're far too large a group. But the 16 who stayed, we all looked after each other, and we all knew each other. Most of us had all been in similar places. I mean, remarkable people. We'd all been in Afghanistan, Pakistan, Chechnya, you name it, in times past. We weren't that close, in fact, though, while we were living and working in Baghdad during the war, because we all had different time schedules. I mean, I was doing morning edition, all things considered, and newscasts in between, and sort of my schedule was very different from, say, John Burns for the New York Times, who would, work all night filing for the New York Times and then sleep in the morning. And not that he didn't work really hard, but our schedules were just very different. So I had armor and was very fortunate. So we tended to work alone, but we would sort of convene for the Information Ministry's press conferences. We had to. It was sort of command performance. You turned up and were looked dutiful and make sure that everybody was there and okay. And if they weren't, you knew it.
We're speaking with Ann Garrels. Her new book is Naked in Baghdad. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And now let's go to Lisa, who joins us from Taos, New Mexico.
Hi, Ann. Listen to your broadcast during the war. We don't have TV either. Live off the grid. My question was, in your experience before the war, did you make any friendships with any Iraqi women? And how do you see their lives changing for the good or bad now that we're having the non-war war?
I met lots of extraordinary Iraqi women. First of all, the whole society is you know, been completely turned upside down, and not just by the war, but this began really with the Iran-Iraq war, and then the invasion of Kuwait, and subsequently the sanctions. And this is probably women have been affected as much, if not more, than anybody. Literacy, for instance, in Iraq, and in the early days, Saddam did some great things, educational institutions, healthcare. There was a lot of good things, which he squandered horribly with wars. And women, literacy was 88%, let's say, in 85. By 90, before the invasion of Kuwait, it was already down to 45% because there was just no more money. And it was what we call new literacy. You know, people had just learned to read. They maybe got to second grade. But if you don't continue it, people lose that ability.
An awful story you tell about a woman who brought in her ill son, and who was ill because she couldn't read.
That's right. He had been bitten by sand flies and just had no idea what to do. And the doctor just looked and said, this is utterly preventable. But in this case, this was, you know, who's the first to lose their jobs in any given society when, you know, the economy goes to hell in a handbasket? It is women. Who, if you've got a choice between sending a man and a woman to school, who goes? The boy. You know, tens of thousands of men, hundreds of thousands actually, were killed in the Iran-Iraq war, then subsequently in Kuwait. And then after that, you know, men left Iraq in order to work. So women, a lot of young, talented women who should have been going on to university and working, A, couldn't afford to, and B, their families were saying to them at the age of 16, middle-class families where, you know, who a generation ago would be educated and go on and get further degrees, and where their families were saying, listen, if you're going to get married, you got to get married now at 16, 17, because there are no men. The whole demographics of the society, it's also become much more conservative because of both trends in the region, as well as, you know, people seeking solace in a religion in the midst of madness. So it is a much more sort of fundamentalist, a more fundamentalist society. And I wouldn't call it a fundamentalist society. And you've certainly seen it since the war. Women are locked inside. I don't think a lot of women are going to be going to college since the war, now that colleges have opened up, because they're afraid to go outside. They're afraid of kidnappings for ransom. They're afraid of rape. They're afraid of threats, theft. Their families don't want them out. You don't see many women on the streets at the moment because their families are so frightened for them in this security vacuum that we call Iraq.
Lisa, thanks very much for the call. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
We got 30 seconds, and here's an email question from Kane in Denver, Colorado. What did you do to relax, or were you ever able to relax?
Well, I had a bottle of Bordeaux every now and again, I have to confess. I was a little, and relaxing was, luckily, as I say, sleep, I can sleep anywhere, and just put me in a moving vehicle or just, you know, just after finishing all things considered, I would just hit the ground, sometimes the ground, sometimes the bed, depending on the circumstances, and I'd just sleep.
Ann Garrels is on a book tour promoting her newly published Naked in Baghdad, The Iraq War as Seen by NPR's Correspondent. After that, back to Baghdad?
Back to Baghdad.
Annie, it's wonderful to have you here in Studio 3A.
Well, it's great to talk to a great friend.
Oh, thank you. In Washington, I'm Neil Conan, NPR News.